today. What would it mean for America if Joe Biden is elected as its next president tonight?
You know me. You know my heart. You know my story, my family story.
One of the lines that Republicans used against Biden was to call him a socialist.
Ask yourself, do I look like a radical socialist with a soft spot for rioters? Really?
But it was actually an awkward fit for Biden because he had really spent most of his career as a centrist, carving this middle line between the left and the right.
Evan Osnose is a New Yorker writer who has just completed a biography of Joe Biden.
And when he entered the presidential race,
the single most important thing we have to accomplish,
it was very clear what his goal was.
Is defeat Donald Trump.
To end the Trump presidency.
Beat Trump.
He didn't think that Americans want a fundamental political revolution. In fact, at an early fundraiser in New York, he promised not to, as he put it, demonize the rich. And he said nothing would fundamentally change. And that quote, in fact, opened him up for some mockery. People made posters in the style of the great old Obama posters in which it said nothing would fundamentally change. But by the time that Biden had basically clinched the nomination, he had really begun to describe his candidacy in different terms, in grander terms, more ambitious terms. In fact, there was a phone call that Joe Biden made to Bernie Sanders in which he said, according to a Sanders aide who was listening in, "I want to be the most progressive president since FDR."
How on earth did Joe Biden, the politician who could oust Donald Trump tonight, go from a walking embodiment of democratic centrism to a man promising the most radical agenda since the 1930s, when Roosevelt rolled out sweeping economic reforms through his New Deal? In this episode, we're going to look back over Biden's life and career to try to understand what drives him personally and politically, and what it might mean for the US if he is elected tonight. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, what type of president would Joe Biden be? Evan, throughout your career as a political journalist in America, Joe Biden has always been a high-profile politician and someone who you followed and watched and interviewed on a number of occasions, most recently this summer after he became the Democratic nominee. Tell me about that meeting.
I have to say, this was one of the more unusual interviews I've ever had. I mean, this was in the middle of the pandemic, and Joe Biden was being kept largely away from the public for very practical reasons. I mean, they were worried that as a 77-year-old man, it could be a very dangerous thing for him to be out. And he lives in the suburbs outside of Wilmington, Delaware. He has a house on a sloping wooded lot that overlooks a small lake. And because of the virus, they didn't want me to go anywhere near the main house. And so the Secret Service brought me to a little carriage house, a little cottage, where his mother used to live.
Welcome to my mom's house. How are you?
She's done pretty well.
And when he came,
I'd walk in and she'd be in that chair downstairs, facing the fireplace, watching television.
He was wearing a big white N95 mask.
She said, "Joey, if you build me a house, I'll move in here."
What mood was he in?
He was anxious, to be honest. It was an unusual mood for somebody who is now the nominee of their presidential contest.
"I thought you could defeat hate. You can't. It only hides. It crawls under the rocks. And when given oxygen by any person in authority, it comes roaring back out."
He was constantly thinking about the sheer scale of the catastrophe that the United States was facing in the pandemic, that if he wins this presidential election, that he would in fact be contending with an almost monumentally difficult set of problems.
Were Trump not running, I probably wouldn't be running. But it was, he's so contrary to everything that I believe about government, and that's sort of the antithesis of what I think we should be doing.
And he was also very focused on the fact that he was dealing with a competitor who had already said that he might not accept the results of the election.
It's going to get really, really ugly. He is going to continue to lie. And what I do worry about, to tell you, Evan, for real, is I worry about them screwing around with the election outcome. And, you know, he's, you know, when the hell have you ever heard a president say, I'm not sure I'll accept the outcome. You know, I'm not committing to that.
I mean, he probably could never have imagined that he would have been facing a candidate like Donald Trump. And yet he almost certainly did imagine that he would be in this race. In fact, he is on the brink of a dream that he's harbored for most of his political career. When did he first talk about a desire to become president?
Interestingly, he's been talking about wanting to be president since he was barely out of his teens. On one of his early dates with his late wife, Nelia Hunter, he met her mother. And her mother asked this young man taking her daughter out on a date, well, what do you imagine for your future? And he said, well, I want to be president. And then he added, of the United States. And there was something ludicrous about that. This college junior who was almost prematurely old, he in a little way, he carried himself a bit more like an adult than he was.
He was only 29 years old when he made what was a pretty audacious run for senator.
It was. It was sort of an outrageous thing to do in some ways. I mean, the senator he was running against was an institution in Delaware.
Joseph Biden, 29-year-old challenger of Senator Caleb Boggs. Boggs, 63 years old, going for his third term.
He'd been in office for a quarter century. He was a veteran of World War II.
He's been everything. Mr. Delaware.
And Joe Biden was nobody.
Joseph Biden, 29 years old. He's had 2 years as Newcastle County Councilman. And he has been a vigorous young challenger.
But he decided somehow that he was the voice of another generation.
Biden said it's time that we had somebody who'll yell in Washington about taxes and ecology and so forth.
He believed in things like environmentalism at the time, which were still very sort of nascent movements. And he ran ads that said, Joe Biden knows what's happening now. And that was a sort of subtle, not so subtle dig at his opponent. And it worked.
It was an audacious bid, but it paid off. There was a shock result. He won the race. But before he actually took up the job, his life changed dramatically in an instant. Tell me what happened.
His wife, Nelia, was taking their three kids to go buy a Christmas tree, and they were pulling out into a busy road, and they collided with a truck, and it was a catastrophe. And his wife, Nelia, and his daughter, Naomi, were killed instantly. And his two sons, who were at that point ages 2 and 3, Hunter and Beau, were both hospitalized. And initially, he thought of suicide. He didn't think there was any way he could take his job in the Senate. It all somehow seemed kind of pointless. Frankly, he wanted to kind of disappear from public life. And his sister, Valerie, told me that in the end, he didn't have the luxury of disappearing because those two boys were depending on him. And some older members of the Senate said, come and try it for 6 months, and then you can decide what to do. And he did that.
I make this one promise that if in 6 months or so there's a conflict between my being a good father and being a good senator, which I hope will not occur, I thought would, but I hope it won't, I promise you that I will contact Governor-elect Tribbett, as I had earlier, and tell him that we can always get another senator, but they can't get another father.
And because he was a single father, he would come home every night on the train rather than stay in Washington. And it meant that he wasn't really a part of the Washington social scene. And it gave him a slightly different perspective on things because he was taking the Amtrak every night. And it became the beginning of this reputation. And people would joke that he was Amtrak Joe, this kind of slightly self-conscious man of the people, but actually it was a reflection of the brutal reality of his life, which was that he was the only parent his kids had left, and he was trying to raise them on his own.
This was a phenomenally quick rise to power for a young man. What did he do with that power? What were the kind of positive achievements in the early parts of his career?
When Joe Biden was rising in the Senate, he turned out to be extraordinarily politically adept. He was just very good at being a senator. He rose fast.
Senator Biden serves in two of the most important and demanding committees of the United States Senate, Foreign Relations and the Judiciary Committee. As chairman of the Judiciary Committee, he steers the course on the most difficult and controversial issues of our day.
For too long, our society has looked the other way at this nightmare.
He was the author of the Violence Against Women Act.
It's shameful but true that our legal system condoned violence against women for hundreds of years.
I have the right to legally prosecute the abusing person. I have the right to be, and I have the right to be me. And Senator, as a former victim, as a mother, and as a woman, I thank you for your time and your sincere interest.
And, you know, it's very easy to poke fun at the old Amtrak Joe caricature, but he was the one who was actually always talking about matters of economic fairness.
And for a decade led by Ronald Reagan, self-aggrandizement has become the full-throated cry of this society. I've got mine, so why don't you go get yours?
He was at home in a union hall in a way that a lot of the more sophisticated Democrats, the ones who had gone to the better schools and spoke with a little bit more eloquence, that they didn't. They just fundamentally didn't understand that kind of struggle because they just hadn't been through it.
Is there anything from those early days in the Senate that help us to understand why his politics moved towards centrism?
Yeah. As soon as he got to the Senate, he realized that he was getting pressure from both the left and the right. And that was a real reflection of the area that he represented. Delaware was almost perfectly divided between the culture of the North and the culture of the South. It had elements of the Jim Crow segregation tradition, and then it also had elements of the Northern tradition. And he was trying to balance both of these, to reflect both of these constituencies, frankly, to get reelected. He had come to office running on a platform of civil rights. He'd participated in desegregation protests as a young man in Wilmington. And yet he came to office and found that his constituents on issues like busing, which was, after all, the process of bringing black students into white schools in order to integrate them, his constituents in Delaware wanted him to take this position of being opposed to a specific kind of court-ordered busing. And he moved sharply to the right.
And of course, these things are not forgotten. As we know, Kamala Harris, now his running mate, put this to him in the primaries.
That you were wrong to oppose busing in America. Then.
No.
Do you agree?
I did not oppose busing in America. What I opposed is busing ordered by the Department of Education. That's what I opposed.
Well,
I
there
did
was
not
a
oppose
failure of states to intervene.
How quickly after that was he pushing to achieve his ambition to be president?
Well, almost as soon as he got to the Senate, he started to imagine himself in larger shoes.
After conceding just last weekend that no one knows me, Senator Joseph Biden of Delaware today became the fifth Democrat to declare he's seeking the party's presidential nomination.
He started to run for president in 1987.
The clarion call for my generation is not, it is our turn, but rather, it is our moment of obligation and opportunity.
And it didn't go very well.
Democratic presidential candidate Joseph Biden today faces a controversy.
Biden seemed to be claiming Kinnock's vision and life as his own.
He, at one point, took the words of Neil Kinnock.
Why is it that my wife is sitting out there in the audience is the first in her family to ever go to college?
Why is Gladys the first woman in her family in a thousand generations to be able to get the university?
My ancestors who worked in the coal mines in northeast Pennsylvania and come up after 12 hours and play football.
8 hours underground and then come up and play football.
It's because they didn't have a platform upon which to stand.
There was no platform upon which they could stand.
He had taken words from Bobby Kennedy in a speech.
cannot measure the health of our children.
The health of our children.
The quality of our education.
The quality of their education.
The joy of their play.
For the joy of their play.
Biden gave Kennedy no credit.
And Biden also claimed to have graduated in the top half of his class.
Biden now concedes he did not graduate in the top half of his law school class.
That, of course, wasn't true.
That he does not have 3 degrees from college, and that he was not named outstanding political science student in college.
For a long time afterwards, Biden was very prickly about that experience.
I don't think it will have any effect, but I don't know. You all will make the judgment about that. It'll all depend on how you write it. I don't mean that. I'm not being smart. It all depends on the American people looking at me. They're going to look at me and say, is Joe Biden being honest with me? Or is Joe Biden not being honest with me? I'm being honest.
He liked to imagine that it was the press that drove him out of the race, and they focused on superficial details.
I mean,
but
they're
it was
not
only
that superficial, are they? I mean,
no.
Plagiarizing speeches of other politicians is quite serious. Pretending that you did better than you said at school. I mean, that's a criticism that Donald Trump still uses against him today.
Well, I think one of the things that was so interesting to me in this research for the book was that it took some years before Joe Biden was, frankly, ready to acknowledge, as he did quite candidly, that the reason I lost in that race was my own arrogance. I think it gave you a window into what a young Joe Biden carried with him, which was some sense of insecurity and a sense that he was desperate to prove himself, especially because not too many years earlier, he had been almost crippled by a stutter. It made it almost impossible for him to speak publicly. And he had mastered the ability to speak by practicing in front of the mirror, by learning poems, and by reciting great speeches. And that had given him this almost kind of preternatural confidence, maybe a little too much confidence, to imagine that he might be president someday.
What happened next?
Well, he had a terrible turn in his health right after leaving the presidential race. He suffered a pair of aneurysms, basically a ballooning of the arteries in his brain, and it nearly killed him. It was serious enough that the doctors called in a priest to deliver last rites. But when he was operated on, they said, you may lose the ability to speak. And he said, well, I kind of wish you had done that to me last summer.
Oh, I like that.
We are all pleased that he has been given a clean bill of health by his medical doctors.
The parliamentary inquiry.
The senator from Delaware, Mr. Biden.
Okay, so he did recover from that turn. He continued as a senator. In fact, pretty soon Bill Clinton would be on his way to the White House. And clearly, this was a hugely formative time in Biden's politics and in the politics of the Democratic Party. Tell me what was happening at the time and how it helps us to understand Biden.
The Democratic Party at that point was in a kind of crisis. They were losing one presidential election after another. They'd lost 5 out of the last 6. And so they decided to move further to the right. And there was a generation of young politicians who embraced that idea that for them to succeed as a party and personally, they would have to find a more conservative form of the Democratic Party. And Joe Biden was on the edges of that. He wasn't at the center, but he was certainly one of the people who was swept up in what became known as the politics of personal responsibility.
This was a period in which there was plenty of controversy as well.
The hearing will come to order.
Biden oversaw hearings for Supreme Court nominee Clarence Thomas, who was accused of sexual assault.
Today, the Senate Judiciary Committee is meeting to hear evidence on sexual harassment charges.
And
that have been made against
he faced
Judge
fierce
Clarence
criticism
Thomas
for failing to allow witnesses to appear in person to support those claims. There are also sexual assault allegations against Biden himself.
She says in 1993, Mr. Vice President, that you
came years later from Tara Reid, but refer to that time when she worked in his office.
Would you please go on the record with the American people? Did you sexually assault Tara Reid?
No, it is not true. I'm saying unequivocally, it never, never happened. And it didn't. It never happened.
And journalists have not been able to dig up corroborating evidence. And then the question of race was back again with the 1994 crime bill.
Let me set the record straight.
on this bill. The underlying bill, which is now the Biden-Hatch bill, was the Biden bill.
That many look back to and say opened the doors to mass incarceration of black men.
It doesn't matter whether or not they're the victims of society. The end result is they're about to knock my mother on the head with a lead pipe, shoot my sister, beat up my wife, take on my sons. So I don't want to ask what made them do this. They must be taken off the street.
How much damage did supporting that do to him?
Well, it didn't damage all the people who supported the crime bill. In an interesting way, one of the things that is a surprise for many to discover is that Bernie Sanders supported the crime bill in that period. He was a member, of course, of the House of Representatives. And so did the Congressional Black Caucus, emphatically. They believed this was something that needed to be done to try to address the crack epidemic that was racing through so many American cities. And they say, we were not seeking to lock people up for these long, terrible sentences. What we thought we were doing was addressing a serious problem by using the power of the Congress. And Joe Biden was in that situation. He looks back at it now and says, the mistake that we made was we thought crack was different and that we had to take these drastic steps in order to protect people against it. And that was a mistake. And we went too far and it was wrong.
And it isn't just that period which Biden finds himself having to defend today. You write in your book that some progressive Democrats see his voting record in the late 90s and into the noughties as an indictment because of votes in favour of deregulating Wall Street, backing the war in Iraq, and liberalising trade. Is there a way to reconcile those decisions today?
There's a great civil rights activist named Cornell William Brooks who said to me, look, if I go back and I look at Joe Biden's record, I say there are things that he did that I would never agree with, but I can't indict him without indicting the Democratic Party, which after all, I'm a part of and believe in. That was the failure of where the Democratic Party was, and Joe Biden was a part of that.
Friends, today I file the necessary papers to become candidate for president of the United States.
He was back running after his prize again in 2007 and 8, famously beaten by Barack Obama, who then surprised people when, as this radical young black candidate, he chose Biden to be his vice president.
That we won't just win this election in November, we will restore that fair shot at your dreams that is at the core of who Joe Biden is and I am and what America is as a nation. So let me introduce to you the next president, the next vice president of the United States of America, Joe Biden.
What did he see in him?
Obama had gone through this really interesting process of coming to understand Biden. When they first encountered each other, Obama had listened to Biden hold forth during a committee hearing in the Senate and had scribbled a little note to his aide in which Obama wrote, "Shoot me now." But over the course of the next couple of years, Obama had come to really rely on Joe Biden as an advisor on questions about foreign policy and national security, which Obama didn't know much about. And then he watched him debate during the 2007 presidential campaign and came away sort of impressed with Biden's ability to handle himself on the debate stage. And then the blunt fact is, Biden represented something that Obama had a hard time accessing. Biden was close to working class whites in the Middle West, and that's where Obama was going to have trouble making headway as a candidate. Sometimes Biden used to joke that Obama would send me to the places he doesn't want to go, and he meant that mostly in the realm of foreign affairs, but it also meant talking to members of Congress. Biden loved doing that. Obama didn't. And so in some ways, these two men saw in one another the way to make up for the things that each one of them lacked.
It was also a period, wasn't it, where there were quite a lot of gaffes.
Yeah. They were known as Joe bombs among some members of Obama's staff. And part of it was that Obama never says anything he doesn't mean. He rarely has a syllable out of place. And of course, Biden operates in a different way. He came from the Senate.
Would it be an order that...
in which people speak all day long, constantly, and very little of it is meaningful and recorded. It's just the sort of ambient wind of being a member of Congress. And so he was scrutinized to a degree that he hadn't been before, and that took some getting used to.
And I also am told that...
At one point in the 2008 race...
Chuck Graham, state senator's here. Chuck...
He was addressing a crowd, and he turned to a Missouri state senator and called him to get on his feet.
Stand up, Chuck. Let him see you.
Before realizing...
Oh, God love you. What am I talking about?
In fact, that the man was in a wheelchair. He just was immediately regretful.
I tell you what, stand up for Chuck.
Then there was another time when they were celebrating the success of passing the Obamacare bill.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States of America, Barack Obama.
This, just a little sense about Obama's facial expression that he knew at any moment that Joe Biden might say something a little bit wildly out of the ordinary. And he said into Obama's ear in a way that was rather unfortunately caught in a mic, he said, "This is a big fucking deal."
Thank you, everybody.
And I have to say, I mean, just as a citizen, as an observer, as a political reporter, there's something about that that you find in the end kind of alluring, because it is an obvious kind of candor. The man can't help himself.
Yeah, it definitely makes him seem more human.
Yeah. And sometimes when it seemed as if Joe Biden was making a gaffe, actually there was a little bit more political calculation behind it.
I'm curious, you know, the president has said that his views on gay marriage, on same-sex marriage, have evolved, but he's opposed to it. You're opposed to it. Have your views evolved?
In one case, in 2012, Biden came out and signaled his support for gay marriage, and he did it before Obama had done it.
I am absolutely comfortable with the fact that men marrying men, women marrying women, and heterosexual men and women married men are entitled to the same exact rights.
And at the time, people thought, well, that's Biden just making a mistake again. But actually, this is an example of Biden making a reasonable recognition of where the center of the Democratic Party was moving.
Biden considered running for the presidency in 2016. He'd recently lost his son Beau to cancer. And you write that, as well as the grief, one of the things that stopped him was the realization that Obama probably wouldn't back him. Why was that?
Obama wasn't really in favor of it. Obama worried that Biden's candidacy could divide the Democratic Party, or it might also add an embarrassing failure at the end of this long career of public service. And so in the end, Biden decided not to run for president.
Good morning, folks. Please sit down.
And he gave an announcement in the Rose Garden with Obama by his side. And it felt really in that moment as if it was perhaps the end of this four-decade pursuit of the presidency, this dream of his, which had gone all the way back to that day when he told his girlfriend's mother that he wanted to be president.
Thank you for all being so gracious to Jill and me for the last 6 or 8 months and for our whole career, for that matter. But I'm telling you, we can do so much more.
We know what happened next. Hillary Clinton ran, won the popular vote, but lost in those key states like Pennsylvania. You write that in the aftermath, Biden would tell anyone who would listen that he would have won. And maybe that's why, even aged 76 at the time, he couldn't resist the urge to try again.
This will be Biden's third bid for the office. He came
pitching himself as the centrist who you've described against the more radical offerings of candidates like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. And he suddenly, unexpectedly won, didn't he? How?
There was a period in which his campaign really was quite close to the end.
Biden has a big problem. Mm-hmm. And the big problem he has is not only the deficiencies it showed in his appeal, but he is dead broke and he mm-hmm. needs to raise money.
And yet beneath that, there was this hidden strength to it that was sort of invisible to the public, but it resided in a lot of the relationships that he had developed with other people in the party. And that became very important as the race approached this critical moment. And South Carolina, this was really the make or break time for him. South Carolina's Democratic Party is, after all, mostly Black. And he had developed a long relationship with voters there. They knew him. And Jim Clyburn, the congressman from South Carolina, came out and gave an absolutely pivotal endorsement.
But I want the public to know
that I'm voting for Joe Biden. South Carolinians should be voting for Joe Biden, and here's why.
And what you saw was fascinating, that across this political spectrum of this very broad Democratic Party, from centrist moderate figures like Amy Klobuchar all the way to Bernie Sanders, they coalesced around him fast. And Bernie Sanders explained why. He said, look, I'll be candid with you. I have a better relationship with Joe Biden. I've always had a better relationship with Joe Biden than I had with Hillary Clinton. He listens to what I have to say. So what you saw was the product of years of, frankly, listening to people. And it came to be decisive for him.
Coming up, if he wins, what kind of president would Joe Biden be? Evan, what I really want to understand is how on earth we go from the Joe Biden you've just told me about, staking out the centre ground in the 80s, 90s and noughties, compromising constantly as vice president, being the Democratic presidential candidate of incremental change, to the politician who calls up Bernie Sanders and says he wants to be the most radical president since FDR.
Usually a Democrat running for president leans as far left as they can in the primary and then runs to the right in the general election in order to try to win over moderate voters. And Joe Biden did the opposite. You know, I think you could look at it and wonder, well, does this mean that he is just trying to pretend he's something he's not? But actually, and I came to believe something, as Barack Obama put it to me, that really, it wasn't that Joe Biden changed. It's that the circumstances changed in such a distinct and dramatic way that the crisis the United States found itself in really pulled him to the recognition that the United States could not afford anything but dramatic reforms.
The way I feel about it is I'm kind of in a position that FDR was. I'm not comparing myself to FDR, okay, for real. So it's not like Biden says he's like FDR. But if you think about it, what in fact FDR did was not ideological. It was completely practical. How do we keep America from going totally in the tank and staying in the tank?
It's the fusion of his personal imagination of always wanting to be a great president, always wanting to be a great person in history, and the moment in history. Those two facts merged and forced him to become a more ambitious politician than he might have been otherwise.
But he embraced it by reaching for the ideas being put forward by progressive Democrats. Shouldn't we be cynical about that, given what you've described about his political values?
I think if you look at history, what you find is no, because very often it is not the most progressive, the most dynamic members of the party who have achieved some of the most important progress in Democratic history. Take, for example, LBJ. I mean, as somebody said to me, he wasn't the hippest, wokest guy in the party, and yet he achieved the most important social legislation of the post-war American political period. And that's partly because he was somebody who came from the middle. He could sell things that somebody who's more overtly progressive cannot. And I, in this case, defer to what Bernie Sanders says, which is Bernie Sanders would not have embraced Joe Biden the way he has, as enthusiastically as he has, if he thought it was not real.
I mean, when you say that, I am slightly reminded of the young Joe Biden you were telling me about, that energetic young man in his 20s who wanted to contrast himself against what I guess he saw at the time as the dinosaurs of the party who didn't understand what young people needed. I mean, there is an irony on that. Would some not say that it's strange for a white man heading into his 80s to be leading the charge on this?
Look, there's something clearly odd about the fact that at this very progressive moment in America, that it is somebody who comes out of the party history in some ways, not out of the party future. And yet that is also the fact that might make him, and I think it does, almost uncannily suited to this moment, because he comes to it with a reservoir of political skill and relationships. And there's a reason in the end why Joe Biden is the person who was the last the last Democrat standing in this field, because he figured out how to wind a path between knowing what it is that needs to happen and knowing actually how to do it.
So we've come to a position where many young progressives, not all of them by all means, but many of them are backing Biden wholeheartedly. And part of that is the original narrow aim of his candidacy that you mentioned, that he wanted to remove Trump. But these are young people who are not scared of calling themselves socialists. They love Bernie Sanders. They love AOC. Joe Biden is hardly their poster boy. What pressure are they likely to place on his presidency if he wins?
Substantial pressure, and well they should. I mean, I think if Joe Biden is fortunate enough to get elected president, I think the left side of the party will probably begin pressurizing him about 30 seconds after he wins. And that's the way the system...
Wait that long.
Yes, exactly. That's the patient version. And I think that's the way that the system should work, and that's the way history works.
People are fed up with an economic system that has reigned supreme for 40 years that he was deeply a part of advocating for. Yep.
I've spoken to a number of progressives who, as Varshini Prakash said to me, she's one of the co-founders of the Sunrise Movement, one of the very active climate change groups, is that
if he doesn't have a way to meet his incrementalism with the level of transformative change that people are crying out for, he's going to be in deep trouble.
If Biden, and it is a big if Biden is elected this week and becomes president in the new year, what can we expect from him straight away?
I think the first thing he's going to do, I mean, as we say on day one, is return the United States to the Paris Climate Agreement and rejoin the World Health Organization. And those are more than symbolic achievements. Those would be the kind of thing that signify that the United States is returning to an awareness of its responsibility to its own citizens and to citizens of other countries, and to say we're rejoining the world, that the period of America First is over. And from there, they have a legislative blitz ahead of them. I mean, usually a president gets about 2 years to get things done before the midterm elections scrambles the politics of Washington. In this case, they don't have the luxury of 2 years. The simple emergency of the pandemic and the economic crisis means that they have to move faster.
Through all of this, one thing I really want to understand is what drives Joe Biden. Like, what motivates him? Why is he in this? Is it personal ambition? Is it enjoying the role of being at the heart of government? Or is it something else about society? Given all the research you've done, all the people you've spoken to, including himself, but all those around him, do you have an understanding of that? And are you convinced that he isn't just shifting now for his own personal reasons?
Look, nobody who's being honest with themselves about running for president doesn't believe that they are ambitious. Barack Obama did not set out to be president because he lacked personal ambition. And that does not make it also exclusive. The reality is people run for office because they fundamentally believe in the power of government to change people's lives. And that's Joe Biden's basic belief. If you use government right, that you can make things a little fairer, you can make things a little more full of opportunity. And, you know, long before Bernie Sanders was running for president, I interviewed Joe Biden, and he said to me that I think that the working class is getting a raw deal. The Democratic Party, his own party, is not paying enough attention to them in this country. And frankly, I was too foolish to realize, me, the reporter, to realize just how important what it was that he was saying. I didn't get it, and I didn't quote it. And that was a mistake. I realized he was onto something. And in a strange way that nobody might have predicted, we see it in the enthusiasm that has eventually come to settle on the recognition that Joe Biden is the person who simply needs to be president now.
And what if he doesn't win? What does it mean for America? But also, what does it mean for Joe Biden? Will he be leading the charge against a second term for Donald Trump? Or will he finally accept defeat and retire?
I think if he doesn't win, it's over for him. I don't think there's any question about that. But more gravely, frankly, I think if Donald Trump wins a second term in office, that will signal a turn in the American story. It no longer is it an aberration. It becomes at that point a kind of new direction for this country, and one that should worry all of us. And it's about something much bigger than Joe Biden.
Evan, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That was Evan Osnose, a New Yorker writer who covers politics and foreign affairs, and whose book, Joe Biden, American Dreamer, is just out. I really enjoyed it. Do check it out. A huge thanks to Evan. And we've reached the big day. Those Americans who haven't already voted are heading out to the polls as we speak. We, like I'm sure many of you, will be staying up tonight, and we're going to make a special episode of Today in Focus, speaking to Guardian US correspondents based across the country, including in critical swing states. And we will aim to bring you as many results as we can by morning UK time. We may go out a little later than usual if we need to. I hope you've been enjoying our coverage in the run-up to the election. It's all been down to our brilliant colleagues at Guardian US, and I do encourage you to get on the website and read their pieces today and follow the results on our live blog with Joan E. Grieve overnight. Now, before we go, I want to mention our brilliant sound designer, Axel Cacoutier, who, if you're a regular Today in Focus listener, I'm sure you appreciate. Not only does he beautifully sound design episodes, he also composed our theme music. He's had two really prestigious awards in recent weeks, first being chosen in the Radio Academy's 30 Under 30 programme here in the UK, and then this weekend he won a gold award in the documentary category at the Third Coast International Audio Festival in America. It was for A Shortcuts, that was an audio self-portrait inspired by his journey back to his birthplace in the Ivory Coast, and it was brilliant. A huge congratulations to Axel. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Rose Dell'Arabiti. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. See you in the morning, maybe with some results.